Welcome to the One Last Sketch Podcast, a show dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and history. Today we're talking about a form of history, I suppose. Internet history for this, our 38th episode, What Happened to the Internet? I'm your host, Michael Wojcik, and I'm joined by...
the usual guest, Marie Goshmarak.
So this is your idea, Marie, so I think you need to give a rationale as to why you suggested this as a topic.
Well, that's not fair. I suggested this a really long time ago. Okay. Well, you know, I think it was in some sort of conversation that you and I were having, one of us arrived at the conclusion that, you know, the internet just, in terms of entertainment forms and things, just doesn't appeal to me as much as it used to. And I wondered if, you know, that's me, or you, or the both of us, or if it's, in fact, the internet. So, there you go.
And we are millennials,
yep.
Which is the first generation, hypothetically, that grew up with the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Practically, that's not actually true in my mm-hmm. case, but I do think it's true in yours.
Yeah, I remember good old... Windows 95 is my earliest memory. So the whole thing's kind of funny, because the internet existed for a good decade before really either of us were around. But I don't think it was really important or commonly used until around when we were kids. So, yeah.
Well, I definitely first encountered it in school with really bad dial-up. up north that made it basically impractical and or useless in most cases to use or access. So that wasn't the best introduction.
I don't think I remember dial-up so much. I think that by the time we had it when I was a child, it was when cable was already starting, and I think we leapt on the cable bandwagon. So I don't actually have a memory using dial-up so much myself. I know people had dial-up around the time that I had cable, for sure. Lots of people. Probably people including the school. But, yeah, I don't actually remember that so much. It's almost a little bit ahead of me. But you grew up in the 1930s, so...
Yeah, I didn't have internet at home until I was 17. Didn't have a computer mm-hmm. until I was 12.
Mm-hmm.
When I did get internet, it was dial-up, so yeah. It was very slow.
We had a shared family computer, and then we had two shared family computers. And I remember I mainly used, like, the word processor was what I mainly used the computer for as a kid. And there was, like, a kid version of a word processor. And it didn't go on the internet, I think, until I was, grade 8 or 9? I'd say around then. That must have been, let's see here. I have to do some math in my head. Probably like 2003.
So what that comes down to is that we were both in high school when being on the internet kind of became parts of our lives.
Yeah.
That's when I got my Hotmail account.
Yep.
which I still have.
It's one of the first things I got, too. It might still be out there. I don't think they, like, die. I think they sort of... Well, maybe they do clear the
I still way, use actually. My Hotmail account. I have the same email address that I had when I entered high school. when I would go to the computer lab or mm-hmm. the school library at lunch and look at forums and stuff. Yeah. So that's kind of when it really began to have an impact.
I remember I got Hotmail was probably the first thing I did on the internet, because there was a friend of mine who had moved away, and she told me to get an email account. So I remember saying that with my parents so that we could exchange emails, which was nice to be able to, you know, electronically communicate. But since it was like the 2000s, early 2000s, like you check your email every few days, like it didn't really, it was similar to checking your mail in terms of frequency. Plus, I was a kid, so it's not like I was getting anything important. And then I remember, like, I don't know if you use the IRC chat whole lot.
I used MSN at the very end of high school.
Yeah. No, it was like old JavaScript and like chat forums, and it was basically a really nerdy forum. Another friend of mine had found this forum and said you should come chat. It was kind of neat to talk to people. Basically, people never really said anything important to each other, as far as I could tell. And it seemed to be a lot of like socially anxious and avoidant people, because you could see who was in the chat, but really there'd be like 20 names listed, but there'd really only be like two or three people chatting. And it was just this whole kind of unusual social experiment thing. And eventually I realized that I wasn't really having the same interests as the other people that were online, so I just stopped doing that after a while.
A large part of the internet is this strange social experiment, because at its inception, the idea was we have this giant source of free information, everything's hyperlinked, hypertext was a big... kind of philosophical notion at that point.
And HyperStudio was like pushed in school, because we both remember making hypertext stuff.
Yes, we both remember that.
It was so much fun to make a simple little game in hypertext.
And the dream of hypertext became the internet. Mm-hmm. So it was this whole new way of presenting media, and it was supposed to be this giant tool for democratizing information. Probably maybe this is why it came to mind for you now, is that sitting in 2018 and looking back, that's kind of what happened, but not really.
Yeah, I think the next
it
thing
democratized
that's
misinformation as well, we'll put it that way.
I think the thing that's next most relevant here would be what I remember when Google became the default search engine, because for a long time there was Yahoo and then there was Ask Jeeves, I remember using in school. And there's also, like, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was online, so I sort of used that a bit. I remember Google slowly overtaking it and being taught search engine strategies and things in school. And I remember Wikipedia starting. Because back in that Windows 95 time, when, you know, you'd have to make a cup of tea while your computer was starting up, I remember having, like, an encyclopedia on a CD disk that you could look stuff up that would have more information than the Britannica, which we did have at home, because... bunch of family of that of nerds type people.
Yep. I had the World Book Encyclopedia, and when I got not my first computer, but my first computer that wasn't garbage, we'll put it that way, it came with the Encarta Encyclopedia.
It was Encarta,
on CD-ROM.
Yeah, I remember Encarta. And it was sort of like, when Wikipedia initially started, I remembered... like, in high school, you couldn't use it at all. And then, kind of around university, early undergrad, is when it started to become sort of legit, kind of, you just had to check sources. And now it's actually pretty... it's not bad for a decent amount of basic information.
It's graduated to perfectly okay.
Yeah.
Still not an academic source.
No, not for anything that's meaningful or higher level. I will admit, looking up, frequently using it to look up really basic medical information when I'm just like, ugh, I know this thing, but that's based on me confirming what I already am pretty sure is the case. So, and not otherwise, I do have to go back to primary literature.
So, talking about Google and Wikipedia, we have seen this consolidation of... regular person's internet activity around a few sites and services. But when the internet started, it was this free-for-all where everybody had a GeoCities webpage with terrible, broken HTML.
Yeah. I never really investigated the GeoCities sites so much. Like, I knew they were there, but whenever I looked at them, well, like, I think the design was so awful. I was like, I think books are better, was my opinion at the time.
There was GeoCities, there was Angel Fire. I remember in high school, a lot of my time was spent on an Angel Fire site that still exists called Warp Spawn Games, which was just a guy posting... or it was a group of people who were just posting board game rules, like several of these per day.
Yeah.
I would print them out and take them home to look at.
Yeah, like, I remember I looked up, like, stuff about drawing was something I looked up for, because people would illegally upload, like, cartoon drawing guides, and I remember printing those off so that I'd have them.
Yeah.
But then I think I didn't really spend that much time online looking at things or really reading blogs or such. And until I think that probably the thing that unfortunately made the internet a normal integration in my life was probably when Facebook started, I would suspect. And so, around the same time, just prior to that, I think, was when I'd realized that webcomics were a thing. And I started to read a lot of different webcomics. Which is sort of the thing I was thinking about most when I suggested this podcast, was around that kind of thing. Because I got on the webcomic bandwagon and read a lot of different things for quite a while. And that led to reading articles and stuff. And then with the social media starting, then it sort of became a thing where you'd be on daily, more than once a day kind of thing, for long hours, checking up on stuff. And that's when I remember suddenly the internet, and around, I'd say, about 2008, 2009, was in my life all the time.
So despite me getting the internet a lot later than you, those were some of the first things that I started doing at school with the internet, was looking up stuff and finding blogs and these aggregator sites of board game rules and forums and all that kind of long-form text conversation that was taking place over very... Now we think of it as over very long periods of time where you have these forum threads that lasted for months or years that would just keep going up. So how I've structured how we're approaching this topic is I've split it up into a few different areas just so that we can keep this manageable, because we're already rambling like mad. And that's just when talking about the internet as this entity is going to happen. It is a service for delivering information, and that information takes many forms. But there were some forms that were popular back when it started that have kind of died off now, and new ones that have showed up. So the first thing I have on my list is forums, which was definitely my introduction to obsessively checking certain websites on the internet.
I think you have more to say about it, so I'll just say my bit on forums briefly. I think I originally did probably read some fora content, but I think what I found was just that I found it sort of a very confusing way to get information and how people would reply, and it wasn't clear to me. And I was like, I can get information from a book much faster because I'm quite Luddite in a lot of things. So I think I just never really got on it. And it'd probably only be more recently where I've realized that this is a good way to find usually DIY tips is usually what I find forums are useful for. And that's about it. So I never really spent much time there.
Well, forums were a chronological set of posts set in a thread. So you'd have topics. It was generally hosted on PHP. So if you wanted to get that snippet of information, it usually involved reading a lot. Basically, this enormous transcript of a conversation that often didn't go anywhere.
It's like trying to figure out the answer to a question from reading a transcript of, like, several people talking at a pub about whatever. It's basically what it was like to get information from a forum.
But interrupted by enormous email signatures that took up half the screen. On the other hand, there were very interesting conversations that took place on those sometimes. And the amount of dedication and research that some forums would put in, some forum users put into their posts, was mind-boggling. And even now, there's some cases where this is the only place you'll find someone having discussed this thing in detail and done the research for it. Is it in some forum post from 2001? That's for a forum that's generally dead, because most of them are. I was very active on the Tolkien forum, and this was back when the movies had just started coming out. And there is a lot of stuff on the Tolkien forum that I would classify as scholarship for the, just the amount of time and thought that some of these people put in to what they were writing. And I don't feel like this really happens anymore, where people write a post that's basically a 6,000-word essay to put on this private forum that you don't know if it's going to disappear or not the next day.
I mean, I have a feeling that the reason is that back in the sort of time period you're talking about, like 2002, there were, I think, fewer internet users. And the people who used it tended to be nerds, tended to be people who were interested in that kind of thing, and would probably read each other's 6,000-word essay. People now wouldn't even read that much. And so you're sort of thinking of your audience as in the writing of it.
The other part of it is there just wasn't that many ways to get your content published easily back then. Mm-hmm. If you didn't know HTML and you didn't want to sign up for a GeoCities or AngelFire account, all you needed was an email address and you could sign up for a forum, and that would provide you with a voice, and it was guaranteed that somebody would read it that had similar interests to you. So a lot of these fan forums just don't exist anymore, or haven't been posted on in forever. Just personally, I find that the only forums that I check regularly now are professional related, private writing forums and that kind of thing, where people are talking about opportunities or networking that you can do. But fan forums are not really a thing unless you count Reddit. Reddit, I think, is the only forum that has persisted, and that's mainly because it's structured entirely differently. It's not really chronological. The whole process of upvoting and downvoting things makes it more like a link farm than it is an extended conversation between users.
Well, and I think because probably people our age might have remembered forums, but definitely current people who are currently the age that we were in that time probably use Tumblr, probably use Instagram and other sort of things just to have that kind of conversation. And it's usually not talking about, the Lord of the Rings so much.
Well, it's another case of these conversations have been collected under a few services instead of there being a thousand forums and web rings that might have 10 or 20 people posting regularly.
Yeah. Because there was such that spirit of, there's going to be all these possible different ways that people will use, and each one will choose their own way. But ultimately, evolution occurred, and the easiest or preferential, for some reason, thing lasted, and the other ones just died out. Like, MSN Messenger isn't around. People don't really Facebook message so much the same way. It had to change. Lots of AOL Messenger, I think, is gone. Lots IRC chats are gone. They're not around anymore, as far as I know.
Yeah, so that brings our conversation to the next topic, which is blogging, and in particular, LiveJournal and e-zines. E-zine is not a term that anybody uses anymore.
No.
But it did exist as a evolved form of the fanzine. And just the zine in general. I guess hipsters still make zines these days, but that's not really a thing. When we were in high school, zines were definitely a thing that people put together. And e-zines were an outgrowth of having this weird, very personalized, low audience number publication that, instead of photocopying it and distributing it around your town, you would post it on the internet and get about as many people reading it.
I mean, it's just because I think I probably looked at one issue of an e-zine or two. There weren't that. Again, I didn't really read e-zines because I think the content was usually not that great. So then I wasn't that interested in it.
I had a few posts that were on e-zines back in the day, but those, either those sites don't exist anymore, or I don't really visit them, and their traffic has definitely plummeted since those days.
Yeah,
LiveJournal's still around.
Yeah.
It was bought by Russians, and I think nobody wants to use it in the West anymore because they're afraid their private information is being harvested. So.
And you've told me about the drama that goes on LiveJournal, and I've enjoyed hearing about the drama of LiveJournal, but I've never experienced it again.
Yeah, LiveJournal was, I think, one of the first major blogging platforms, mainly because it was free. I mean, this is how these things really got launched off the ground on the internet, was if you didn't have to pay for the service and it gave you a place you could post stuff, people would flock to it. I mean, it worked for Facebook. It definitely worked for LiveJournal back in the day. Mm-hmm. And LiveJournal was structured in such a way that you would have a friends list.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was in this half space of almost being like later social media, but still being a traditional blogging platform, that caused this drama where instead of calling people followers, you called them friends.
Mm-hmm.
Just doing that was enough to make LiveJournal a hellhole. I was not on LiveJournal. It was the first website that I think I purposely said everything on this is garbage after a while.
Yeah.
And it was largely because all of the blogs hosted there would devolve into this infighting inevitably of people complaining about losing people on their friends list.
I mean, blogs in general, there was this, that it was the whole, like, it's the real free press thing. And people were very excited for a while that there'd be loads of people writing stuff, publishers would find you, and the best would be, like, sorted out, and the dreck would sort of quietly fade away, and it hasn't really happened, I don't think. It's weird to me now that there are people who call themselves bloggers as their job, but I think it's a pretty rare person who's able to sustain themselves with that as their only activity. And I feel like in a lot of ways, it's been first come, first serve. There are probably some bloggers who've always been around, so they're kind of just managed to hold on by name value of some kind. But I'm not really sure if actually a lot of people who have this kind of blog column have really lasted. I think the best ones are usually attached to newspaper sites, or they're already authors or writers who are decent at the craft itself. Or they're really specialized interests, like lots of craft blogs or kind of things where if you're basically offering information on something and people might follow you that way. The only blogs that I've read were usually anecdotes from medical people because, you know, the stories were interesting. And there is currently one blog I follow because it continues to be hilarious, and that's about it. And, yeah.
Definitely the personal blog, while it still exists, is not as popular.
Definitely not in the long form posts. Because even I don't read. If a post is very long, I'm not really that interested in reading it either, because there's lots of other things I could be doing.
Fortunate, because there were some blogs that had really good articles on them. And the advantage of the blog over the forum is it's not ephemeral. That article will stay up basically for as long as that person has hosting for that blog. And there's conversation happening in the comments below if they have comments turned on. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't get lost in a lot of bickering, which is generally what happened in forums.
Yeah.
So it was a better spot for stuff like that, definitely. When I started blogging, there was definitely a lot more traffic and a lot more sense of community. I still maintain my blog, which is mainly about art, writing, and sometimes weird history stuff and a lot of book reviews.
And I largely don't. But which is not uncommon for lots of people in medicine who start blogging and then hit residency. Most of the blogs die around this time.
What I write now is generally self-contained. It's just something for fun that I'm putting up. And when I started, like, me posting an article, just starting a blog would somehow cause a giant internet storm for no reason, where you had dozens and sometimes hundreds of people talking about this thing. That's definitely gone, and I would say good riddance in the cases where I was involved. It's a lot more pleasant now to just quietly post your thoughts instead of suddenly discovering that some famous author has started talking about you on the internet because you said put one sentence about them on your blog posts. Generally doesn't happen to me anymore, but it was also that activity that was happening. You would meet a lot more people over the internet than you would now. People were a lot more willing to comment on stuff, which they don't really do anymore. People will comment within their social media spaces, like I share this article, and I will only have this conversation with people who are following me on Twitter, or who I'm friends with on Facebook, or whatever, or who is on this Reddit subreddit that I'm on. But I generally don't post in a place where the author of that article could easily find it.
Yeah, I think the comment thread itself has evolved. We'll probably talk about that later when we talk about some of the other things that we're going to. We'll put a little bit on comment threads, I think. Because that whole thing has sort of changed, I think, a bit over time.
For sure. So unlike forums, blogs still largely exist. Most authors have them. But they tend to be more personal, more specialized, and more attached to someone's greater persona. For it's not just I'm a blogger, it's this is my blog, I'm also this person who does a bunch of other stuff. So if you visit my blog, you can also find out about the other stuff I do.
And I think it's actually kind of been a good thing that blogs just become this way to sort of share extraneous parts of what people do. Because then I think people become good at those other things versus just being someone who makes a blog. Because that's not actually someone I want to actually know anything about if all you do is blog.
What that leads into, though, is vlogging. Specifically YouTubers. YouTube, I think at the tail end of high school, is just starting. So I couldn't actually visit it because I was on dial-up at home.
I remember YouTube. I do remember when it just started, and I wasn't that interested in it until I think actually around when like Facebook was starting, because then people would post the videos on Facebook, and you could see them, and be and my attention was drawn to how there would be entertaining things on it. I remember just before YouTube, Homestar Runner being actually the thing that I spent the most time on the internet on. I'm just remembering that now, which is sort of funny because Flash is no longer even a thing that's supported online.
Yeah, there
but
was.
I actually did watch religiously all Homestar Runner that has ever existed through the portal originally. That was probably what I spent most of my time on.
Yeah, there was Homestar Runner, there was Newgrounds.com. Which is where the Maya He guy started.
Yes.
I guess actually the Numa Numa guy is the correct term.
Numa Numa, yay.
So I remember Newgrounds was probably the most popular site that other people visited when I was in high school because they had Flash games there that were usually terribly offensive. I think that was
That was kind of in keeping with like Happy Tree Friends, which I watched one thing of and said, no, I'm not watching anymore. This is terrible. Similar sort of just violent cartoons because of the lack of, you know,
quality control.
I suppose you could call it that. Censorship was the other one I was thinking of. And I remember just prior to those things, more in the junior high school, like Neopets being a big thing. And there were lots of little Flash games on there.
StickDeath.com was big when I was like in grade 8, 9.
Oh yeah, I remember StickDeath.
Yeah, but what we're talking about now is Flash animation, which had a very brief period of popularity that just completely died when, well, why did it die? I guess better software came along.
I think it's just because Adobe Flash was, like most Adobe products, incredibly cumbersome as a program. And so easier ways of animation came around, and people probably started using that. And I think most people started to put things onto YouTube if they animated something, and YouTube kind of took over a lot of those things. You can now find Homestar Runner on YouTube. They've actually uploaded everything there because Flash, no longer being supported, it's had to go there instead so that people could still see it.
Yeah, and then people started uploading their faces when bandwidth could suddenly support actually having video. So YouTube doesn't have a 10-minute cap on its videos anymore, but it did when it started.
Which, oh, yes.
In part led to the classic vlogging style that we see now of very frequent awkward cutting. Which
it had not just a 10-minute cap. It also had a total file size cap. So it was one or the other. If your file size was, if your video was just too big, then it wasn't going to allow you to upload that quality. So you had to choose which one you were going to go for, the time or the quality.
So again, vloggers are not something I really follow anymore, but definitely when I was in undergrad, I did follow vloggers who were just went off for 10 minutes about some topic or another.
I watched Hot for Words, who was basically just a sort of a attractive Russian lady who did etymology. And I really liked etymology and thought it was fun. And I thought it was funny that she was kind of doing it in a sexualized manner. So I watched it. It was great. I learned a lot of roots of words. Eventually, though, what I found with vloggers is that they would get more and more ambitious in their production. Instead of sticking to sort of just a vlog, some of them would start to, like, act out things or do really primitive costuming and sketches. And then it just became obvious how amateur the production was. And then I was like, I can't tolerate this. It's just not good enough.
Yeah, that definitely leads into video reviewers, which I watched a lot of these back in undergrad. Something that YouTube maybe doesn't support as much anymore because of DMCA takedowns, where they would, because they would use frequent clips of the things they were talking about or analyzing. And now that's very hard to do without getting your video taken down for copyright concerns.
Yeah, I mean, there is, you are allowed, if you're reviewing, to have a short clip of no more than a certain amount of time, but probably not as long as they'd really like.
Yeah, so there were a lot of these for video games especially, but definitely for bad movies. There were a lot of them. Like, I would watch the Spoonie Experiment rigorously. Sometimes I would watch the Nostalgia Critic.
I watched Nostalgia Critic, and I also watched CinemaSins initially, and then eventually the joke got old, so...
Lindsay Ellis is still making videos. I still watch her stuff, but for a lot of these people, they've either stopped. I think it just, they were making their living off this thing. And if you weren't willing to put in the time and effort for increasing your production quality, people would just not be able to support themselves with ad revenue unless you were able to attach yourself to a Patreon account or something later on and get a lot of support. Like Lazy Game Reviews, which I still watch religiously, is mostly not about game reviews. He does, like, here's a video of me going to my local Goodwills and all the stuff that I've But he definitely has a dedication to quality in his content that a lot of these video reviewers and vloggers from back then just could not possibly equal.
A lot of playthroughs. I basically watched Halloween 4545 because it was funny. Then after a while, I'm like, again, this gets old for me because I'm not that much into video games. And I think one of the things that was kind of unique was that you'd sort of form a relationship with the person creating the content. Because you could actually talk to them, and they would actually respond to what you'd say, which is different from, say, watching something on TV. It was, I think, the attractive part of it, even if the quality was quite poor in a lot of cases. And I found that, in general, people either... We'll get into this some more when we start to talk about the web series part. People would either die out, or they'd go professional, meaning that they'd have to actually invest in quite a lot of things to be able to keep going and become a larger group. One big section that I watched a lot of was abridged anime, which was starting with
Dragon Ball Z Abridged. Watch.
Oh, I still watch. It uploads very slowly, and since they cannot make money from it, given that they that would be a big copyright infringement, they have to do, like you talked about, videos of other things that aren't directly related to the thing to give them some income, and they also have to have their regular lives, so I don't get upset about upload times. I feel like people are less upset about people pausing upload times or having a slow upload schedule than they used to be, because I think people now have a better understanding of the amount of work required in making something decent, and they just don't complain about it so much.
Yeah, people, there's so much content on the internet now, I think, is the other part, that
you're
not really starving for something else to watch, and it's far preferable. It's far preferable if somebody uploads something that doesn't look like crap to see on an infrequent schedule than a video every week that looks terrible, which was the case with a lot of the vloggers back then, is that's kind of how it went. But yeah, I definitely agree about being able to form a personal relationship of sorts with the vlogger was a lot of the appeal, that you could directly talk to them and get a response. That doesn't happen anymore, or very rarely. You are more likely to get a response from sending a message to a famous artist or writer right now than you ever would from an internet personality. They will not say a thing back to you.
I think it's just the sheer volume, probably. I guess the other thing, and it's sort of appropriate now because The Key of Awesome has actually just stopped, the guy
so
who creates
many
it.
Sites have just ended in the past year.
And this is what I really kind of spurred wanting to do this, because I think a lot of people, you know, you move on with your life as life goes on, and it's like any production thing, like some sitcoms exist for a period of time, and then eventually the actors and producer want to do something else, and then they go and do something else, and that is starting to happen, I feel, with some series that are on YouTube. People are like, I want to, you know, move on, and they can do that. That's fine. I'm actually kind of happy that The Key of Awesome has the guy that creates it, Mark, has made this choice, because, you know, you can tell that it's starting to get a bit tired and a bit more work than joy in what he's doing.
So, that's certainly what happened to web series, which we had an entire podcast about web series. I think we recorded that just when they reached their peak. Like, that was just before all of these series were going to end and never come back.
Yeah. So, and we got whole things on Lizzie Bennet, on LARPs, on Humans and Households, and, oh, what was that other one? The Job Hunters. Like,
Job
lots
Hunters.
And lots of great web series. Ultimately, though, I think just the cost-benefit analysis is there's so little income to be generated from this.
Yeah, the ones we talked about are still fantastic.
They're great.
You can go on, you can watch The Guild, you can watch whatever. They're all generally of very high quality and very entertaining and good, but they weren't sustainable, is what it came down to. YouTube ad revenue was not enough. Patreon can support like one person or a small group of people, but not sustain something like a web series, which has a lot of people generally. They're still working for free usually, but that's part of the problem. It still costs a lot to get the actual production going off the ground. Maybe not. It doesn't maybe cost a lot of money, but it definitely costs a lot of time.
And I mean, people were happy to work for free when they're in their early 20s. And things don't matter so much, but like now I'm 30. Like probably a lot of this cohort of people who are making that stuff are getting to this point where it's like, I need to have a career because, you know, there's lots of financial important things I need to be able to do with my life.
And then for younger people, it's just not the path to whatever success they're looking for that it used to be. Because if that well is kind of dried up, the people are going to benefit from it. And they're not going away anytime soon. It's kind of like our generation's problem with the baby boomers. It's the next generation's problem with making money on the internet.
Yes. The old guard YouTubers, they're still there. And some of them have been able to adapt. Some of them adapted or were taken over by more professional things, like the obvious one being BuzzFeed. Which
I can't read anymore.
Yeah. And for about a year, I think I watched BuzzFeed, and then I realized what utter dreck it is.
Well, it's the same kind of things that happened with Cracked and these other giant aggregator sites that had a very specific formula to what was written on them. Once you figured out the formula, it just made you just not want to read it anymore. Because you'd figure out the code. There was nothing really left there for you.
And I read a lot of Cracked, and then the predictability. But I think, I mean, BuzzFeed's still around, and there's a lot of stuff where, like, BuzzFeed people are leave BuzzFeed because they're tired of the mill, because I think it's pretty grueling to work for these.
And they don't get paid very well.
Because the massive company only works by kind of having a large group of people making a large amount of videos that they can advertise on them. And, so that's sort of what happened to YouTube. Otherwise, I'd say the next big thing that's kind of goes on, but maybe losing interest, would be stuff like Fail Army or basic stuff that used to be like America's Home Videos, and now it's just...
Yeah, that stuff's also kind of on its way out.
It is,
it's something that's not on its way out, which is our next topic, is webcomics. But I think the form of the webcomic has changed significantly.
Yeah. There's only two webcomics that I read now, and I read them when I first started in, like, 2008 or 7 or whenever I started reading webcomics. And that's The Order of the Stick and Something Positive. A lot of the other webcomics that I read have ended, because basically the story is over, or the artist was done creating it. So, like, Girls with Slingshots and Queen of Wands and... There's a couple I just lost interest in. I just honestly forgot about, like, the Dreamland Chronicles and Girl Genius and a couple of other things. Or a couple of Wopsy Square, or a couple of, like, months later, I suddenly realized I hadn't read it in a long time, and then also realized I had no inclination to go back and do that. Usually because the quality had fallen off, or the story was just getting so pedantic and slow.
So what made webcomics great is that there were so few... ins for comic artists back in the day. Like, if you wanted a newspaper strip, you basically needed to be boring. And if you wanted to work for DC or Marvel, you were also very constrained in what you could really publish. So there was already this very active culture of self-publishing stuff, by which I mean making the artwork, producing the books, bringing them to your comics bookstore, that was happening. And the web was just this massive, convenient shortcut to doing that that didn't have nearly as much pain in there and allow a lot of stuff to get out that otherwise wouldn't be published. I think there are a lot more avenues now for people to publish graphic novels that are outside what was acceptable or considered the norm back then, which is why there was such an explosion when we discovered them. There were a lot of webcomics. A lot of them were gag strips. Because getting a newspaper gag strip, not very likely. So everyone who wanted to do a gag strip, that was basically either you were at a university and publishing it at your university newspaper.
Yep.
Or
like
you
some
were
people,
uploading it
like
to
myself.
The web. A lot of those gag strips still exist, but I don't read them anymore. I'm definitely for that era, like Hark a Vagrant, definitely the...
Oh, yeah.
Epitome of this style.
Oh, my
Very
God.
Funny.
So good.
Like we talked about vloggers, Kate Beaton has generally moved on to print publication now.
And has a life.
Artwork. Yeah.
Yeah. And has a life.
Like she works as a professional freelance illustrator and all that jazz, which gets a lot more money than selling cups and t-shirts.
That was the fundamental, I think... I want to say identity crisis for webcomics artists, is that you'd put the comic up for free, which was the primary thing you made, but your revenue came from the accessories you sold. Because no one would buy a subscription, because ultimately the internet trades on things being free and trades on advertising. It did lead to like something like Project Wonderful being created, and Project Wonderful is a pretty cool idea. But otherwise, yeah.
Those gag strips mostly over for me. I don't really read them anymore or they don't exist. But I did find in the past few years there's been a definite shift to people doing long-form storytelling in comics, which you haven't really gotten into. But I
well, I got into residency, Michael, and yeah. you know, like I said, yeah, my own you need the time.
Well, I definitely got into them, and part of it was something that came out of Korea, which was mm-hmm. the webtoon, where they'd specifically make comics to read on your tablet or phone, and they were mm-hmm. formatted in that way, mm-hmm. that kind of created a space where people could publish this stuff and make a bit of money off of it, which didn't really happen before, because you didn't have these giant mm-hmm. webcomic aggregator sites like we have now. Like, we have Line Webtoon and a bunch of other places. Tapass, I think, is the other one.
Yeah. I mean, most of the comics I read, either they were hosted on their own individual websites, like The Order of the Stick is on Giant and the Playground Games, or they'd be on a WordPress.
They were mainly self-hosted. That's not really the case anymore, because, mm-hmm. like, how much money are you really going to make from your little donation box and your Patreon mm-hmm. button off in the corner? But for whatever reason, long-form storytelling like that wasn't really the thing back in the main period when we were reading webcomics. They were mainly gag strips.
I think it was the upload rate, because like with YouTube, where at the time the expectation was you were supposed to get things up daily, like have a Monday to Friday schedule, you needed to have a shorter script to actually meet the demand of your readers.
Definitely, so... I've mentioned Carcafona on the podcast before, which comes out very slowly, but is of a quality of artwork and pacing and paneling that you would expect from professionally published work. Mm-hmm. I'm reading Cut Time now, which is the same, very good artwork, but also it's not coming out at that frequency that stuff was really expected to come out as before.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and I mean, both the ones I still read that I mentioned, The Order of the Stick, I think, uploads maybe, like, weekly. I don't know, once every 3 months or something. Like, it's really slow. Because, again, people, I think, have to do other things with their life and have lots of other reasons. And that one does have an ending coming. Like, I do know the plot is forecast to end. That is the creator's plan. The other one I read, I don't know if that's ever going to end now, because I think he's actually past the time when he had expected it to end, because given how long it's been all going on, I think his life expectations have changed, and his cynical view of how it would end hasn't actually panned out, because you mellow with age. So,
yeah, so that old model that was really, this is how you have success in webcomics, was just a giant recipe for burnout. Most of the people burned out. What's left is people who are putting a lot of time and energy into longer form stories, but they're publishing them in places where they can have a reasonable income. Or in the case of Carcafona, you can just buy it in book form and it will be a better experience.
And indeed, The Order of the Stick I do buy in book form anyway.
Yeah.
Because I'd like to support the guy that makes it and all that. But I remember creating comics for the University of Alberta newspaper, and just even publishing once a week. Man, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
I don't really... Every now and then, like, my dream of it sort of, like, comes up in my mind, and then I remember how much work it is and how impractical it is to do anything else with your life and create a good quality product. And I'm like, I'm not doing this. So
that dovetails into the opportunities the internet gave to artists. I'm thinking especially right now of fantasy and science fiction art that you would only really get from book covers and maybe some movie concept art and posters. And definitely now the internet has provided artists who draw and paint geek stuff a space where they can do it full time and you can see a lot of it. So that's been a positive development. This is where Patreon and Kickstarter are at their most powerful and important.
And there's DeviantArt.
Yes, and there's DeviantArt, which had a very, still has a pretty bad reputation for what it was back when we were in high school, university.
It was pretty DeviantArt, all right.
I have a DeviantArt account now, DeviantArt account, that basically just functions as a very basic portfolio, which is what the site is now. It's a place where you can sell prints if you're so inclined and have a basic gallery. That's not really what DeviantArt was back in high school at the beginning of university for us.
No, it was centaur porn, so
that was the place to look for, oh, somebody drew this? Why?
It was oddly fascinating in that way, and you're like, this is the underbelly of the internet for those of us who are too scared to go into 4chan and places like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we skipped over talking about forums was 4chan was very important to internet culture back at the beginning of university, end of high school for us. That's where memes were generated. There's this rolling anonymous conversation where stuff would just disappear after a while. Yep. And it ties into this topic because it was an image board. That's primarily what it was and is. It was supposed to be a place to post images, and I think Tumblr has basically taken over that particular aspect. At some point...
And Instagram.
Yeah, and Instagram. So 4chan was based on 2chan, which was a Japanese thing, which I think also still exists. 4chan became a den of Nazis, and that was basically the end of its importance to the internet at large. Kind of Reddit kind of sits in that area now for posting images and links, I think, and is also has a bad reputation.
Well, and I mean, because I only first went on Reddit maybe a year ago because I had heard of Reddit and Redditors and all these things, and I was like, I've also encountered, like, 4chan and comment threads, and so I didn't have any interest in being on Reddit ever. So
yeah, I am on Reddit, but I follow some fairly low-traffic subreddits and don't look at anything else. I think what really happened was this idea of free expression on the internet was definitely pushed, and it created spaces where... you were rewarded for saying outrageous things, and it wasn't quite clear if someone was serious or not. At the beginning, you assumed they weren't. And then over time, those spaces got populated by people who were.
It was basically sort of, I think, what we qualified in conversation before as when the conservatives found the internet.
Yeah. It's that suddenly there were spaces where you could write these things and you wouldn't immediately get kicked out from them.
Yeah. And because back in the early days of those forums that you mentioned and my IRC chats, it was basically a lot of really nerdy, quite liberal people seemed to be who was around a lot. And then particularly, I think I noticed in the last couple of years, man, is the right wing out.
It was the danger of layering stuff with such a thick layer of sarcasm, which it was a bunch of geeks. They were taking a lot of their pointers from Buffy the Vampire Slayer and how they were talking and would approach things. And a lot of media that was aimed at us had those kind of sarcastic characters and prized being clever and full of irony. And we were raised on stuff like South Park, which was all about... that. And then, yeah, people would say outrageous things for the sake of it to get rewarded for it. And generally they weren't serious when it started, but it created spaces where it was more or less acceptable to voice opinions that in polite society would be frowned upon until that became the main outlet and a recruiting center for that kind of stuff. That kind of covers probably what we were going to talk about in regards to comments.
Pretty much. The only other thing that I'd say about comment threads is that I think, because people used to, I think, be so invested in winning the war, and I think people are not so invested in winning wars on comment threads because our experience with it, I think, as a group, is that it's impossible and that the person you could be arguing with might just be 9 years old and being a dick. And there's not a whole lot of availability or, you know, it's not really possible to win with a well-reasoned argument because it's not like an academic discourse most of the time. So I think since people have sort of let go, I don't, because I still read comment threads, I've always been fascinated to see what people would say back and forth
to
each other.
It still happens on Facebook and Reddit and Twitter.
Where, and I think it might be where people know each other, it can happen.
Yeah.
But I found on YouTube was usually the most interesting place, because people didn't really know each other so much. And now I find that people usually give one-liners back and forth, and that's about it. Because I think the way that people approach commenting is usually just with the not expecting to win anything. And people who are kind of just trolling, I generally usually ignore, because people have figured out that if you don't feed the trolls, then they stop showing up so much.
Yeah, well, flame war is not a term that's used anymore. Flame wars used to be half of the internet. And I think back when we were in high school, I'm sure some of us who are in their late 20s, early 30s, were thinking like, ooh, I can outsmart the adults. They don't know what age I am. I write so intelligently.
I didn't do that in high school. I did it briefly in my early 20s, early university, and then I gave up.
Yeah, and that was not a worthwhile thing to do, because mostly people would just kind of figure out, this person says that they're doing a master's degree thesis on representations of gender in Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time, and you go, this person's 60.
It's like, that's not a thesis topic.
Yeah, you would weave these elaborate stories and personas.
Yeah,
people just don't believe.
And I found now what people tend to do on Facebook. We haven't really talked about Facebook because I don't really want to.
Social media kind of killed a lot of the things we were talking about. So
pretty much. But very briefly, I'd say that I find at least in my group, this may not generalize to most people, is people just sort of block each other or get rid of people they don't want to talk to. Like, they don't keep around the great numbers of friends, and they usually just kind of go, I don't want to encounter that, no, I'm dealing with it. I don't think that's the case amongst teens these days. Having worked in child and adolescent psychiatry, I think the boundary is pretty blurry there. Mm-hmm. But that's what I think people in our age group do. So there's less of this sort of fighting, because you just don't see those people anymore.
Yeah, like, I'm very diligent about pruning my friends list on Facebook to a very minimal amount of people. Same on Twitter.
I pretty much have never reblogged anyone ever on my blog, because I'm like, I don't know who this person is. So, no.
Yeah, the link dump is not something people really do on blogs that much anymore, unless they have some kind of commentary. I mean, I guess that kind of still exists with e-newsletters, which are still a thing. But again, they're attached to, this is an author, or this is a publishing company, or something like that. So,
yeah. Anyway, we've been talking for a long time.
We've been talking a long time, reminiscing over the past 2 decades of telecommunications technology. I don't know if it really says anything of a greater historical import. A conclusion I came to with a friend a while ago is that we thought that the internet would have the historical impact of something like a printing press when it started up. And what it really acted as was an accelerator to make trends kind of flame up and die out really quickly, or to help political movements get their crap together a lot quicker. But in the greater scheme of things, you could remove the internet and end up with a pretty similar geopolitical situation as we have now.
I think I'll probably largely agree with that. I mean, I find that there's a lot of movement. Again, I can only speak from my small impression, because I don't actually have a global view, because nobody does. I think a lot of people are trying to sort of not be on the internet so much. It's what at least I think people are going is to turn things off and to, you know, have normal social reciprocal interactions. Partly, I would guess, because of the type of creature we are, tends to wish for that more. And the internet sort of came about really quickly within one generation, so there's not really a lot of adaptation ability to it.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about a lot of things. We didn't talk about podcasts, which is funny, because we're talking about what we're doing right now.
I have a lot of things to be thankful for with the internet. The fact that we continued being friends after university, largely because we could contact each other over the internet.
Back from that original, let's get an email so that we can email each other. over to, I think, probably Skype. I think I've spent more time with you over Skype than I have in person still. That ratio is still the case.
That is very likely, yeah.
Yeah.
In my personal life, the best thing about the internet has been maintaining long-distance relationships,
mm-hmm.
having a place where you can publish articles and artwork.
I do appreciate the availability of information. I use a lot of, clinical research tools, which wouldn't be available previously in and if medicine was otherwise as it is now without the internet, I think it would be really hard to function as a doctor with the amount of information you need to know. But having this sort of reference tool that you can keep with you on your smartphone is very helpful for a lot of things. And a lot of kind of just dissemination of that kind of information still pretty much works out the same way as sending out journals, only now that you can have them electronically and research them that way. The long-distance communication, I'd say the thing that I'm most grateful for is being able to get information on how to do something very easily and with actually a couple of different examples, and being able to learn if you're so inclined is probably what I think is the best part.
Yeah, I think
we didn't really talk about gaming at all, and I don't think we need to.
We don't need to. Yeah. Gamergate was a thing, still is a thing.
Yeah.
Every gaming reviewer / Let's Player turns out to be a Nazi. Yeah, basically.
There's a reason I don't watch that guy anymore.
As a telecommunications technology, a big deal, I think we both still prefer getting our information through print if we can.
Mm-hmm.
But the internet is often a lot easier and more accessible as a way to get a hold of that stuff. You are listening to us because you have an internet connection. So we're going to thank the internet, and we're going to thank you for downloading this podcast and listening to it and making this whole thing possibly worthwhile. I'm not sure yet.
Or you wasted approximately an hour of your life.
Yeah. You can find previous episodes on my blog. My blog, I say. onelastsketch.wordpress.com. We're also on these nebulous corporate entities, content aggregators like iTunes and Google Play. This particular podcast is hosted on archive.org.
And finally, I'll say, oh my god, net neutrality. Who knows what's going to happen next? Yeah. And you can find my content at yatterpexy.wordpress.com, which, you know, eventually I won't be a resident, and maybe I'll write more. No promises.
Yep, thanks for listening. This is an irregular podcast, so who knows what the next episode will be. But if you like this podcast, recommend it, just with the caveat that we strive for quote unquote quality as opposed to quantity.
Yeah. All right. This is the longest sign off you have ever done for this podcast.
I'm sure it is.
Bye.